This is Mike Thompson, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 26th of October 2011. Mike Thompson, Part 2.
Tell me about the kind of geological questions you were asking of yourself and of Antarctica when you first went down there. What were you hoping to find?
When I first went down? Well, as I say, when I first went down, I don't know that I had any questions. There was one big question. What's there?
Yeah.
It was as simple as that. I did have an inkling of what was there in the sense that as I was doing my so-called training, the geologist who had been working on Alexander Island had come back. And so we actually had quite a lot of chats about what the area was like, and we discussed methods of working and so on. And he, for example... What we were doing, actually, is there's an enormously thick succession of sedimentary rocks with fossils in it. And what he did, basically, was he said, well, I measured this, this, and this. I got that far. If you go to this particular outcrop, I left my measuring stick on the outcrop at this level, and you sort of carry on from there, which is what I did, actually.
Were there any surprises?
Well, unfortunately, I was getting into the surprises, but the trouble was that I was supposed to do 2 years in Alexander Island, but I was late getting there for a whole load of reasons. So I had quite a short season, and I was just getting to the top of the succession where things were starting to get a little bit complicated. And then what happened was there was... one of the two aircraft that we had at the time actually crashed at Adelaide Base T, as it was then. And so the emphasis then was on using the one remaining aircraft to get everybody out of the field. So that was the end of my first season. It was curtailed, basically. And then... For the second year, it wasn't possible to go back to Alexander Island. We didn't have the sort of logistic backup and so on. So I had to work in a completely different area. Again, that turned into quite an epic because of, just the difficulties of operating in those days. We had no mechanical support, and the aircraft were notoriously unreliable in those days, so we had to do everything off our own backs using dog sledges and things. We ran into some horrendous weather and so on. And so that turned out not to be the world's most successful season. And again, it was terribly frustrating because I was just getting into the interesting bits when I had to pack up. But I did make, we did find quite a bit of new stuff and so on. That's what I mean.
Well, what excited you?
Well, we were working on the east coast at a place called Kenyon Peninsula, where people had worked before, and it was known to be an area which didn't really fit somehow. The geology was quite different from anything else that people had seen to the north and the south. There was a little patch where there were some fossiliferous rocks, which sort of lightened the load for me because there was the potential of finding more fossils, which I did do, actually, and expanded the known fauna quite a bit. But there were also quite a lot of other outcrops which had potential, and I only had the time to just sort of take a quick looky-see at them, but not time to crawl all over them on hands and knees. And they still haven't been crawled over on hands and knees, even to this day. And who knows, I would think, if I were back doing what we used to do, our own five-year programs, and saying, here's a place that doesn't fit, we don't know much about it, there's something wrong here, or whatever. You know, that's one of the places I would go back to, because we still don't know exactly what it means in relation to the geology of the peninsula and how it fits in. And that's how we used to work, actually. That was always behind in the back of my mind. You know, what's wrong here? What what's new, you know, why is this place a pain in the geological map, as it were? And that's what we were doing.
Alan Vaughan, who's at Bass these days, he felt that he said that Alexander Island shaped your career.
Did right? he? Well, I suppose it did. It was the first bit I did, in a way. That's very nice of him to say so. I don't know. I never quite thought of it in those terms. It did in this. I suppose you could say it did in the sense that it would be my first field season for real. I was on my own. And that was the other thing, you see. We used to work entirely alone. I did have a field assistant, but I was the sort of an odd man. And most of the time I was left with myself and the field assistant. None of the field assistants I had were particularly oriented towards climbing up hills and whatever. So this would be an absolute no-no today. I would just head off by myself all day long. And I guess the guy sitting in the tent below or doing whatever he was doing was just assuming that I would turn up in the evening, which I usually did do. It was just like...
40 years later, as you were clearing your desk at Bass, what were the geological questions that were being asked then, just a few years ago? How's it shifted from, I wonder what's there in 1963, to...
it shifted more to, I suppose, mechanisms and why, and sort of... getting more into intercontinental relationships and earth processes and things like that.
How do you mean?
Well, you mentioned Alan just now. I mean, he's done quite a lot on the broader picture stuff. You know, once you've done all your mapping and you've found and you know what's there and you know what type of rocks are there and you know something about their origins, and you look at, and then you put it all onto a big map, and the peninsula's 1,000 miles long, for goodness sake, you know, it's huge. You tend not to realise that when you see what I call the bank manager's map, which is the Mercator projection, with the Antarctic as a little white strip at the bottom, and somewhere along it there's a little bit that goes boop and sticks up, and that's the peninsula, you know, and you think it's completely insignificant. It's 1,000 miles long, and there's an awful lot there, and Alexander Island is as big as Wales. It's a huge area. So it's taken us time to sort of map it. And people like Alan and Brian Story and a whole selection of geologists, actually, have started to bring all the stuff together and look at the big patterns, because you find certain types of rock occur in certain areas. And it's not just certain types of rock, but certain types of rock with certain histories occur in certain areas. And you start putting that together, and then you can work out how the peninsula was actually formed and so on. It's more bigger picture stuff now. Yes, and when I in the early days, you're very much focused on the outcrop. There were a few people who had a go at sort of broad brush stuff. Although we go back to our friend Dr. Ady here. It's a very memorable quote, actually, because he instituted a thing called the British Antarctic Survey Bulletin, which he published somewhat irregularly, in the sense that he would save... He was the sole editor for biology, atmospheric science, geology, everything. He put the whole lot together, and he would save papers up, and issues range from a quarter inch thick to almost an inch thick when he, you know... when he'd found the time to sort of complete the editing and so on. And these were things where you recorded all your information. I think that was incredibly useful. A lot of people criticised us for that, but I think it was really useful because people could say, I went here and I found this. If you were a biologist, I went here and I watched all these penguins and I discovered they were doing this, or whatever it happened to be. Basic. Good, solid, basic information. Then you can use that in all the big stuff. But his comment was, the Bass Bulletin's for facts. If you want to write fairy stories, you put those in the geological magazine.
This is not my question, this is Joe's question. I wash my hands of it. Why is geological research in Antarctica important? Why bother?
Why bother? Mm. Thank you, Joe.
Well, I put the why bother in, just to be provocative.
Well, no, I mean, you know, why is it important and why bother? You can sort of go back to the sort of because it's there type answer, if you like. If you're interested in Earth processes as a whole, what you've got to remember is that Antarctica was the centre of Gondwana. Well, not quite the centre because it's sort of eccentric, but all the other southern hemisphere continents and India. We tend to forget that India is actually a southern is part of Gondwana. It's in the northern hemisphere, India, all of it, but actually it belongs in the south. It's in the wrong place. All of those continents were grouped around the Antarctic. So, you know, if you want to understand the rest of the world virtually, the bit that glued them all together was the Antarctic. That's where they all met, in the Antarctic. So, I mean, that's a sort of academic question, I suppose. There always used to be the driving idea that Antarctica contained untold mineral resources and so on. And part of the problem there was that we were all sent south, and in our sealed orders, there was always a sentence at the end to the effect that we should keep our eyes open for potential economic mineral resources. And most of us wouldn't have known an economic mineral resource if it, you know, fell off the back of a bus right in front of us. Nevertheless, there is that thought, and almost certainly it does contain untold mineral resources somewhere. And it's very interesting. Somebody, even though we have the Antarctic Convention on Mineral Resources, and we're not supposed to even utter the word, I noticed that very recently somebody published a paper on what they called a gold deposit. A gold deposit in northern Victoria Land. Now, if you apply the rules strictly, if you use the word deposit, that means it's commercially viable. It doesn't mean you just saw a little glinty bit on the rock. It means there's enough of it to make it significant. And I thought that was an absolute no-no, and I was amazed when I stumbled across this paper that somebody had actually published a paper with that title. I haven't read it, so I don't know what the content is, but somebody has actually had the temerity to do that. And it sounds as though at last somebody has found something of some significance. Anyway, so that was a sort of another driving force. But there's always the other thing is, if you want to understand not just the geological constitution and sort of earth processes, but it also can tell you a lot about how the biology of the Earth operated, the fossil biology, because it's the one place where you're going to find the meeting point where all animals moved and crossed, you know. The last bit to go, for example, was the link between South America and the Antarctic Peninsula. So as you might imagine, there's potential for animal links between Patagonia and the Antarctic Peninsula, much later than anywhere else. But then if you look further back in time and you want to understand distributions of dinosaurs and all sorts of things like that, what you always have to remember, that Antarctica was there between Africa and India and Australia and so on. And if animals wanted to move around, they'd almost certainly go across Antarctica, which of course wasn't covered in snow and ice at the time. It had trees on it and all sorts of good stuff like that, and rivers and lakes and things. It's a completely different place to what it is today.
On the question of minerals, was there any pressure? I'm thinking about the 1980s perhaps now. Was there any pressure for applied economic geology that you were being asked to look?
There was for a very short time.
There was a post created, wasn't there, to look after that kind of stuff?
There was a very short... Apart from the fact that, you know, from time immemorial, since FIDS and then BASS was set up, well, FIDS was set up, there was always this one liner at the bottom of your sealed orders, thou shalt look, keep your eyes open for mineral deposits. Mm. apart from that, somewhere, it's probably, we're talking what, late 70s or 80s or somewhere, there was a period when everybody was asking the question openly, you know, what's the mineral potential of Antarctica? And actually, it was partly because of that, all the greenies got up in arms and pressurized the Antarctic Treaty system into passing the, what was it called, the Convention on Antarctic Mineral Resource Camera or something. Convention on Antarctic Mineral Resource something or other. Mm. And a lot of people would say that what they... It's virtually a hands-off policy. You know, thou shalt not even think it. And
was there a difference between what was written down and what was going through people's minds? They passed this agreement, but privately were people still looking?
Well, no, you see, the thing was, it's a sort of hands-off policy, but there's a counter-argument which says it would be much better to have had a policy which allowed you to exploit mineral resources, provided that you behave in this way and you do this and that. Because if people sign up to that, they have all agreed to behave themselves. The present thing just says hands off, and it's hands off until somebody finds the world's biggest platinum deposit or something like that. And then everybody will say, up yours, you know.
But you mustn't. I guess you knew that 30 years ago.
The lawyers, if the lawyers knew it, they refused to countenance it, you know. And you try and make that argument to a greenie and they won't have it. But that's what's going to happen. And that's why I was really surprised to read this paper. I can't remember where it's published now, but it's not in the sort of mainstream geological literature, and perhaps many people have overlooked it. They haven't found it yet. But I was really surprised to see a title like that being published today, because we'd all been sort of pushed off it. And so we haven't been actively... Well, I don't know. Nobody will admit, shall we say, actively to be looking for mineral deposits. And I can say that BAS has not actively been looking for mineral deposits. As soon as the camera... agreement was published, was signed, then we were sort of warned off. And yet just before that, we had been encouraged to sort of up our activity. Now, the thing was that we had nobody on the staff, least of all myself, who knew anything about mineral deposits. And so on a number of occasions, we tried to recruit people who had expertise in looking for mineral deposits and so on. And people like the Chileans, for example, they had quite a high-profile cruise to the Western Antarctic Peninsula. And they took a whole bunch of their sort of commercial people down there. And there's a report, which I have upstairs. I mean, they published the report in the open literature, showing all the minerals and things that they'd found. Now, I'm not quite sure how effective these people were, because basically it was the kind of thing I could have almost done myself, just whizzing around to outcrops and knocking shiny bits off and saying, oh, look, I found some lead here. And there are places in the peninsula, for example, where there's a proportion of copper in the rock and you get these fantastic green stains and so on. And I can write down copper, you know, as best as the next man. But what it really means is another thing, and you know whether it's anything that's actually worth thinking about is another point. But
so
as an indicator,
at any time were your principles, for want of a better word, were your principles challenged? Were you being asked to do things you didn't want to do in that window when they were thinking about it before it became unthinkable?
I'm not sure it was I mean, put it this way: I wasn't bothered about minerals in Antarctica personally.
Answer the question.
Whether it was exactly a principle or not, I don't know. But yes, we were asked to formulate programs and so on. And I was asked to sort of put together some paperwork and so on, which I did do.
What, in the eventuality, you mean?
No. That's another story. We'll come to that. No, this was I was asked to put together a program for a mineral reconnaissance. No expenses barred, you know. It was just a sort of blue skies type thinking thing, which I did do to the best of my ability, not being an economic geologist, which is makes it a bit difficult, but I did do it. And it was, having spent ages writing things on bits of paper, it wasn't long after that that the tables were turned completely, because it'd be, you had to go and wash your mouth out with soap after you'd used the word minerals. So it was amazing how quickly the turnaround came, actually.
Was this because of the Madrid Protocol?
Yeah, the Madrid Protocol, yes, yeah.
So what was the other story then you alluded to just then?
What was it I was thinking
of? That's another story you said.
Yes, I know I did.
To do with exploiting minerals or not.
Yeah, what was I coming on to? Oh, yes, yes, yes. No, it was the formulation of the... having signed the Madrid Protocol, each country then had to put this into national law. This is one of the farces. You have I gather this is fairly normal with international agreements, but you have an international agreement. But that's not good enough. Each country has to write it down in their own words, which means that different sort of nuances creep in and so on. So every and the whole thing never becomes actually ratified until everybody's, you know, put it into law. So the way I understand it, and I'm no politician, but the way I understand it, you have these things, you come up with a Madrid Protocol, all the countries initial it, but it's only signed by the country when it's been put into law. Mm. And it was what I was thinking of there was the putting into law. Because what really upset me was that it was all masterminded by the Foreign Office and their wretched lawyers. And what would happen is the chap from the Foreign Office would come and not much of a discussion, but he would talk to me occasionally and I would give my views. And he would then relay that back to the lawyer to put into the document. I was never allowed to speak directly with the lawyer. So I have no idea what was being conveyed to this guy. It certainly wasn't geology that was being conveyed to this guy. And that upset me no end, because I was at least one removed from the coal face, as it were, and I knew that the geological view was not getting through to the lawyer, and he was drawing up legislation on the basis of fluff, basically. You know? And yeah, that's what I was thinking of there. So.
Can you fast forward then? You mentioned this wondrous plutonium discovery.
Platinum, yeah. Well,
it doesn't really matter, does it?
Yeah,
no. What will happen, do you feel, when a deposit is found that, despite the logistical problems, is economically viable?
Yes. Well, that's the great worry, you see. The worry there is that people will say, I'm sorry, we're going to have it.
Sod the protocol.
Yes. Whereas, at least if you'd had a minerals convention, which was what was being negotiated in the first instance, which set out the ground rules. This was looking forward. It was looking much further forward, because it was saying, if we find something, what's going to happen? So if we find something, these are the rules for going ahead. What we have now is, you mustn't even think about it. And sooner or later, maybe later rather than sooner, but sooner or later, somebody will trip over something, and then what do you do? Because there's not, the rules go out of the window. And you know, lots of people tried to explain this, but it didn't get through. So wait for World War III, or you know, whatever. I don't know.
Let's talk a bit about the actual practical problems of getting around the Antarctic for doing geological research, and how they've progressed over the time. I mean, you must have started with sledges and dogs, didn't you?
Yes, yes. That's all we had, essentially. I mean, there were two aircraft, two single-engine otters, which were kept at Deception Island. And, I mean, what a disaster. Okay, we did have a couple of aircraft, which was nice, but you have to consider what that all meant. The two aircraft were kept at Deception Island, period. Once they were there, and in those days they were delivered by ship. So the fuselage and with the wings taken off would be delivered on a ship to Deception Island, and once they were there, that's where they stayed. Now, there was a big hangar at Deception Island, and mechanics overwintered and maintained the aircraft during the winter. Now, of course, they may have had quite a good set of spares and all that stuff, but they would never have everything. And it has to be said that they would, from time to time, a repair would have to be jury-rigged, or you didn't have an aircraft. It was as simple as that. So they weren't maintained to the best levels. So that's one problem. So you had two aircraft, your only aircraft, and they were not maintained to what we would regard as proper today. The second thing was that pilots were employed on an annual basis. They were usually seconded from the RAF, or something like, usually the RAF actually, they were seconded from the RAF for one season only. So they'd come down on the ship, go into Deception Island, pick up this plane, never seen the Antarctic before, fly around the Antarctic. They'd spend most of the summer wondering what all this white stuff is and how to land on it and all this sort of good stuff and how to be and what the weather meant and all this kind of thing, getting up to speed, and then they're back to their unit. So there was no accumulated wisdom. So we've got poor maintenance, we've got pilots who are just learning how to fly in the Antarctic and they go home. And the other thing was Deception Island. Well, Deception Island gets its name because it's actually a sunken volcano with a little tiny slot in one side. So it's like an atoll, really.
Neptune's Bellows.
Neptune's Bellows, yeah. And it's not famous, it's infamous for its ghastly weather. I mean, there's usually a great plume of clouds sitting on it. You can sail down Bransfield Strait between the South Shetland Islands and the Antarctic Peninsula. You sail down there and you can see the South Shetland Islands half out of the Manc anyway. And then there's this little blob of Manc right in the middle, and that's Deception Island. There's nearly always clouds sitting on the top of it. So it was an awful place to fly from, because half the time you'd be sitting there thinking, my God, it's desperate today, and the whole of the peninsula could be bathed in sunshine and you wouldn't know it. So for those three reasons, you know, flying wasn't a really great success. And what they used to do is once they'd finally escaped from Deception Island, somewhere hopefully towards the beginning of the season, they'd go down to Adelaide, Base T, and they stayed at Base T all summer, where there were no facilities, of course, for maintaining the aircraft, other than what you could do with your gloves on and something like that. And getting the Twin Otters was a revolution, because at last we had twin-engined aircraft that could fly themselves in and out of the Antarctic every season. They could go back to Canada. They could be maintained in the factory whence they came. We started taking on pilots with long-term contracts for several years. So they would build up their expertise in the first year and then fly for 3, 4, maybe more years afterwards. So they became really experienced Antarctic pilots. And the effectiveness of flying in the Antarctic went up by leaps and bounds.
When did that change take place, roughly?
I can't remember. Whenever we got the Twin Otters, it would be sometime in the 70s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's sometime. It was in the sort of bit early to mid 70s, I would say. But that changed everything. And the other thing it made possible, of course, was it made field work, summer only field work, possible. Now, there was always this gripe, although I said I really loved the bit in the Antarctic of you know, sailing down and spending 2 years in the Antarctic. There, a lot of the younger people coming up, these important scientists, they wanted to go into the Antarctic and do their science and go home back to the nice warm lab for the winter and all that kind of stuff. But it was still quite difficult. And I have to say, it was a group I took to Alexander Island that proved you could actually do a summer project and do and get some work done. So, and that was with quite a lot of logistics problems at the beginning, because the ship couldn't get us into the peninsula as early as we thought. But the idea was, you take a ship into the peninsula, and then you'd be picked up by the aircraft. You'd be flown all over the place, and then you'd go out at the end of the season. And so, in one season, without having to overwinter and so on, you could get all your field work done. And you'd be zooming around with skidoos instead of dogs.
And that was more efficient in terms of the writing up the research, because you hadn't got the elements at the same time as writing your research up.
Yes.
Am I right in thinking that you did the last geologist dog trip?
No.
Wasn't you?
Oh, the last geologist dog trip. No, there were people after me who were still using dogs.
I'll move that bit. And the Twin Otters, I think the Twin Otters got you as far as the Shackletons, didn't they, at one point?
Yes. Yeah, we did all kinds of things. We had a number of international efforts and so on. And what you're alluding to is the time when we got together with the Germans. And so what we wanted to get into the Shackleton Range, which is actually quite a difficult place to get to by overland means. You really need an aircraft to get in there. So we sort of pooled resources. And so what happened is, the year before, was the Navy ship, HMS Endurance, as it was then. They got as far south as they could into the Weddell Sea. Let's think. They took in a load of fuel and helicoptered it into Halley. And then it was moved by Twin Otter from Halley into the Shackletons. And then the next year, a group of British, German, and there was an Italian and a Russian with us as well. We went into the Shackletons. So we went on the German ship. We went on Polar Stern to Halley. And then we flew into the Shackletons using a Twin Otter. And once in... And then we had sort of periodic visits by the Twin Otters. They weren't there all the time, because the Germans had a couple of helicopters that they had hired, and we had sort of two helicopters. So we moved around largely by helicopter in the Shackleton Range with fuel that had been depoted by the British the previous year. And that's the kind of pattern. That sort of pattern is quite common now. I mean, it's not just Bass doing that. All sorts of people are behaving in that way, setting up depots and operating internationally with people providing various bits of the logistics and so on.
Tell me about dogs and skidoos. What's your view on dogs versus skidoos?
Well, the best thing you can say about it is that skidoos don't fight. but they're not as friendly as dogs, if put it that way. I'm really glad that I was part of the dog era. They were a hell of a lot of work and could be terribly frustrating at times. For example, in my first year, I was at Alexander Island, and it was a real pain. Every morning, we were camped at the bottom of a cliff, and every morning I'd walk up the cliff to where I'd finished the day before. And what you've got to, and that'd be measuring up the cliff. And so every day it gets further and further up the cliff before you even start. So I was well into the section. I was miles up the cliff. And I can't remember why I was alone. There was nobody down at the camp anyway. And I was right up at, I walked all the way up. I got to my start point. I looked down. I could hear some barking. I looked down. And there's one, you can see, pile, you know, there's a great pile of dogs down there. They're having one hell of a duff up. So I had to run, scree run, all the way back down, sort the dogs out, and then climb all the way back up again. Thanks, lads. You know, you've been a great help today. But apart from that, I mean, they were good fun and really nice to be with. And I think most people who've worked with dogs has a really, you know, great soft spot for them, and much mourned their retrieval from the Antarctic, particularly in the way it was done, because dogs were on the out anyway. They would have gone anyway. They didn't have to be removed like that, because if they'd waited, a bit like the Falkland Islands, actually, if they waited 2 years, the Argies would have got the Falkland Islands. If they'd waited 2 years, the Greenies would have had no dogs in the Antarctic. You just didn't have to do it that way. So
you had some fun with some of the earlier designs of skidoos, I gather, particularly on blue ice.
Who, me?
Do you not find the skidoos not very good at adhering to ice?
Well, that's true, but that would have been later on, actually. Yeah. I've had several hairy expert things. It's so easy to get yourself into this situation because you're fixed on, oh, I want to get to that outcrop there, you know, and you... I don't know who told you this story, but anyway, well, there's several of them, but and I've done it on more than one occasion. I should know better, but you've got to cross very often around outcrops. You get these areas of blue ice, which are completely, the wind has swept them completely free of snow on the top. So you've only got ice. Now, we used to have, well, initially, the tracks on the skidoos were pure rubber. And on one occasion, a colleague and I were doing what you shouldn't do. I was working with the Americans, and they had no rules anyway, and so we only had one skidoo between us. We had no sledge. They didn't think about things like that, and we went to this outcrop, big blue ice area in front of it, and one of us was driving the skidoo, and one of them was sitting on the back, which is something we don't do in Bass, and this big blue ice area, and we drove up to the outcrop. That was fine, no problems. Did our geology for an hour or two or whatever was necessary, and then we had to get back. And when we looked round, we realised we'd come down a slope. And, of course, the thing would not climb back out. There was no way it was going to get out. And we were miles from anywhere, had no radio, we had only our one skidoo. And so on that particular occasion, the only way to get out was I put crampons on, and the American guy was doing the driving, and I was pushing behind wearing crampons. And it was a hell of an effort, but we eventually got out because we were it was quite an extensive area. And the other thing is, if you're driving across blue ice areas with a sledge on the back, they have a mind of their own. These days, the skidoos have
cleats.
Well, yes. Well, you can usually they have little studs on them or something like that. But you can get them modified to work on ice, so that helps a lot. But sledges, depending on which country's sledges you're using. Now, the good old Bass sledges or the Fidd sledges used to have all sorts of ways of dealing with ice. You'd have these metal keels that you could drop down through slots in the runners, which would help a bit, or you could put you could wind rope around the runners, which sort of gave them a bit of grip on the ground. But nevertheless, that they just tended to wander where they want, and the worst thing you can have is you're busy, and particularly when you're going downhill this time. So you are driving your wonderful skidoo with its cleats or little studs on the tracks, sedately down slope. And the next thing you know, there's this sledge trying to overtake, you know. And once that's happened, you're into dead trouble because the sledge will overtake, it'll pull you round, and then you'll be facing uphill. There's almost nothing you can do about it, and you have to start all over again.
You did quite an epic dog trip from Stonington to Fossil Bluff.
No, I didn't. No, we didn't make it. There were sort of epics along the way, but what had happened was, the thinking was in those days was that we wintered at base T and we were always going to sledge to Fossil Bluff for an early start to the season before the aircraft came down from Deception Island. And that was a bit of a frustration, waiting for the sea ice to form. Mm. And you've always got at the back of your mind the fact that there was a major sea ice, one of the biggest sea ice disasters at not far from Adelaide, at the Dion Islands, where, I don't know if you know the story, but people wintering at Horseshoe went to observe the emperor penguin colony in the winter on the Dion Islands and the ice
work. And people like that.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got that at the back of your mind, and so you're really waiting for good sea ice to form. Anyway, the sea ice formed, and off we went. And we were taking the careful route round, so instead of heading straight south for Alexander Island, we headed left towards the Antarctic Peninsula, sort of, and the idea being to sort of island hop on the way down. So you would always be close to the coast, and you would either, at night, you would either camp on an island or on the land itself. So not much good that that may have done you if the sea ice had gone, because you would then not be able to get anywhere. But anyway, that's what we're doing. That's the way it was done. And we got to Stonington, and the dogs at Adelaide had had a pretty rough winter, because we'd been very short of seal meat to feed them on, and the second year man said, no, let's hang on and we'll spend a few days at Stonington where we can give them a good feed. And so we waited two or three, probably a couple of weeks, I would say, at Stonington. And then we set off heading south. And what happened then? Well, we were doing quite well until we got somewhere around about Terra Firma Islands, I think. And we had quite a snowstorm, and the surfaces got absolutely dreadful. And we were making very, very little progress. And then we heard that the planes had actually come all the way from Deception, were then at Base T. And the decision was taken that what we would do is we would go back to Stonington and fly down. So we never finished the journey, as it were.
The other dog sledging trip I'd like to ask you about is the East Coast Depot Lane trip.
Yes.
Which would be July, August 65.
Yeah.
And there was a particularly bad blow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was...
Can you talk me through that, please?
Right. Well, from Stonington, there are two ways up onto the peninsula and across to the, south into Palmland and across the East Coast and so on. One is up a place called Soda Bread Slope, Northeast Glacier. It's right behind Stonington Island itself. And it may seem the most convenient, but first of all, Northeast Glacier is full of holes. It's actually not a very nice place to travel on. And then when you get more or less to the head of it, there's this place called Soda Bread. It's known as Soda Bread Slope. That's the private polite title. It was originally called Sodomy Slope, which tells you everything you need to know. It was incredibly steep, and it was a place where you would take one food box, which weighs 56 pounds, or used to, one food box up at a time with a team of 10 dogs and you pushing at the back. You know, it was really grueling stuff. And then coming down was exciting, of course. And it probably wasn't that lengthy, but it was long enough to be a real nuisance. So we all hated doing that. And then there is this alternative route. You went across the sea ice and just to the south of Stonington, around the corner a bit, to a place up Nenny Fjord, to a place called Snowshoe Glacier. And there was a nasty bit at the bottom, because there was quite a high ice cliff, where the only way to get the boxes up was actually to put them on your shoulder and carry them up one at a time or haul them up on ropes. But it was relatively short. So once you'd done all that, you would then hitch up the dogs and you'd get the dogs up in one amazing heave. But it was only, it's difficult memory fades, but, you know, 100 feet or so. It wasn't very far. And then you'd be up on the glacier. And then once you'd done that, the slopes, at least, were relatively easy. The travelling from then onwards was much easier, except that Snowshoe Glacier, I have never, ever seen such big crevasses. They were incredible. You'd be sledging along, and you'd see this sort of depression in front of you. And what you realized, what you discovered when you were on it, was that this was a crevasse that was as wide as the sledge and 10 dogs in front of you. The sledge is 12 foot long, and you've got another 30 or 40 feet of dogs in front of you, and you can get the whole lot on this crevasse, and you are not touching either side. So it's absolutely huge. And there would be a crack behind you and a crack in front of you. So it looked as though what had happened was a crack had opened up and the whole middle had sort of dropped down a bit. So it was actually probably quite safe in that sense, in that you'd got a big wedge of ice in there, but it looked absolutely horrendous. You know, it was really pretty frightening to go across them until you got used to it. And then we were sitting up there, and we got this blow, and which lasted several days, and it was absolutely evil, I would have to say. It's the worst. I've been in quite a lot of blows. I think that's probably the worst one ever.
100 miles an hour?
Well, it was something. It was of that order, yes. I mean, it's all done by guesswork, of course. But I think some people were measuring wind speeds around and about, and we don't think we were exaggerating. We reckoned it was 90 knots or something like that. And it was absolutely awful because you almost couldn't go outside because you stood a good chance of being blown away. We could hear all sorts of things going on outside. We were aware you've got all this sort of snow raining against the tent, and you think, well, what the heck's it doing to the tent? And eventually you think, well, we've got to go outside and have a look. And we went outside, and it was frightening because what had happened was all the snow from upwind of the tent had been scoured away. There was nothing holding the back of the tent down. The dogs were in an awful mess. Poor things. You know, their span had been uprooted. They'd all been blown into a great lump. They were. It was like having 10 dogs and a ball of string. You know, it was just terrible. And so, in the middle of this blow, we took the sledge and we put it behind. We anchored it behind the tent to try and make a forced lee that would encourage deposition of snow on the upwind side of the tent. And then we put every food box we could lay our hands on was put round the tent, probably too high, I can't remember now, but we put loads and loads of weight on the valence of the tent, and sorted the poor old dogs out. I don't think they probably didn't get fed, but they probably weren't that bothered, you know. It really was awful. Well, of course, eventually it did abate, and there were a second group of us who were camped a bit higher up. We were relaying stuff up, and we were the lower camp, and there were some people further up. And when we got up there, we found that their tent was in a bit of a state because the wind force had been such that with these pyramidal tents, the whole idea is they're incredibly stable because the wind acting on a pyramid actually forces it into the ground because of the sheer shape of it, which is exactly what it had done, except it had forced it so much, it had forced the canvas off the top of the tent poles, so it was beginning to split at the top and slide down the tent poles. They were, of course, extremely worried, and I think the blow only stopped, you know, another hour, and they would have been in, they'd have had nowhere, you know, nothing. So that was a pretty frightening experience, actually. But having got over that, we never had any more problems. You know, it was all sorted.
Did you contemplate the infant, your maker?
I just cursed him. Why me? You know. You know. You. I mean, if you, I don't really want to get into religion, but I mean, you do really think. You know, you do. I think if anything, it made me question one's maker more than anything else, because you think, you know, why does this wonderful power have to be so horrible?
It's your own fault for being there.
Yes, you shouldn't. Yeah, this is, I'll teach you to come here, sort of thing. But I mean, it's one of the things about the Antarctic. You have this love-hate relationship with it. It can be really evil at times, and then at other times you think, what a wonderful place to be. And
whilst we're talking about walking on water, tell me about the experiments with hovercraft.
Oh, yeah. Well,
this is 87, 88?
Yes. Well, I don't know when it was, but certainly, yes, that was another one of my...
Was it your idea?
Yeah.
Come on then, spill the beans.
There was an area we wanted to work on the east coast of the Antarctic Peninsula. It wasn't me actually doing the field work, but it was an area that was in our programme. It's a place called Seal Nunataks, and it was a particular interest because they are, with one exception, they are a group of islands sticking up through an ice shelf, which has now gone. This is the famous Larsen ice shelf you may have heard of, which is busy breaking up. Well, in those days, they were, in the true sense of the word, they were nunataks. They're bits of rock sticking up through this ice shelf. The interest in those was that they're all volcanoes, very young. And in fact, there was even a claim by... the Swedes, Larsen, their captain, Captain Larsen of the Swedish expedition 1901-03, he claimed he'd seen smoke coming out of the top of one of these things. So the fact that there were potentially active volcanoes, other than Deception Island, which was known about, but active volcanoes on the eastern side of the Antarctic Peninsula was really interesting. And we wanted to have a look at these things. But the east coast of the Antarctic Peninsula, notably the Larsen Ice Shelf, was notorious for flooding. Even right back in the old days, going back to our friend Adi, they had terrible, terrible times sledging down the east coast because you get these warm phone winds from time to time coming off the peninsula. And so all the snow cover just turns into slush and in great lakes and things like that. It's absolutely awful. So I thought the solution was hovercraft. And I finally persuaded the powers that be that this would be a good idea. And so that's what we did. And I said, there's no point in having... You can't have one hovercraft, because if one hovercraft gets into trouble, the only thing that can get it out of trouble is another hovercraft. You've got to have a minimum of two. So they agreed, and we bought two hovercraft. They're things used by enthusiasts around here. You know, it's basically a thing called Zodiac, a sort of rubber boat with a big fan on the back and a skirt round it. So we got two of these things.
Were they open?
Oh, yes, they're completely open.
And so they carry how many people? 10?
No, just two people. In fact, I think we used them like skidoos, so it would have been one person each. So they were just used for one person and food and stuff like that. So you could move stuff around because you can't tow a sledge behind it or anything like that. So that they have to be people carriers and equipment carriers. So it was one person, two hovercraft, two people, a geologist and his assistant, and all their food and lodging in the back. And sure enough, they ran into everything we expected. Really slushy snow up to your waist, lakes and all that kind of thing. But they got around, you see, and they did the job. I was really upset at the end. I mean, I think it was partly the dreaded... dare I say, H&S, which sort of caused the demise of these things, you know, because they were too much fun.
How fast did they go?
Well, in this country, they race them on lakes. There are sort of hovercraft clubs, believe it or not, and people buy these things and race them around. When we were thinking of buying them, I did get the opportunity... Since it was my idea, I did get the opportunity of going down to It was somewhere on the south coast, like Portsmouth or somewhere, we went down and we played with them, you know, just to sort of get the feel and see what these could do and learn how to drive them. And I don't know. I suppose if you really wound them up, they'll do several tens of miles an hour, maybe 50 or 60 or something like that, probably. Although that wasn't our purpose in these. It was merely that the purpose for getting them was to be able to move around over surfaces you couldn't do otherwise. There's nothing would have got over that surface. Skidoos would have sunk up to the axles. You'd have sunk up to your neck. And the only thing that can walk on water, as it were, is something like a hovercraft.
Can you remember the manufacturer's name?
No.
It'll be on the records.
Yeah, no, I can't.
Were they reliable?
Yes. Because as far as I'm aware, the sort of things that can go wrong is, I mean, they're, as I say, they're basically a rubber dinghy or a thing known as a Zodiac or something like that. You have this skirt round the bottom so that there are two and then there's this giant fan on the back. And the giant fan on the back, which is encased in a sort of a wire cage, the giant fan on the back does two things. It blows backwards and downwards. I can't remember now, but there's a splitter, so it creates a great draft, and half of it is forced underneath the hovercraft. That's why you have the skirt. So you've got this cushion of air which holds it off any solid surface. So for a hovercraft, a solid surface is saturated, is solid, hard snow, saturated snow, water. That's effectively a hard surface. Anything that the air can't disappear into. If you try and drive them over soft, powdery snow, you're in dead trouble because the air will just filter through the particles and things, you see. So you've got to have something that is impermeable underneath you.
So in practical terms, then, you couldn't just set off from the base and head for the Nunataks because you're going to cover several different types of terrain, aren't you?
Yeah, you can go over water, of course, and probably there'd be no good over gravel, or at least coarse gravel. They'd be no good on Brighton Beach, for example.
So in practical terms, you have to go round the wrong kind of territory.
And the other thing you have to do is they're not much good on slopes. Okay. You can only attack a slope of a few degrees.
So they wouldn't get up Soda Brit then?
No. Yeah. And so this was one of the things the lads who were working on the East Coast discovered, that very often you come to these sort of lake areas and they'd be in depressions. Mm. Now, what you can't do is go across. You have to contour around them. Because if you want to get out again, you can always go down. But if you want to get out of a depression, if the slope is too steep, and I'm not quite sure what the angle of dangle is there, but it's not very much. If you want to get out, the only way of doing it is to contour and spiral your way out. So the little tricks like that you have to learn, and probably something that had never been thought of in this country because they use them on lakes and things like that. And then all you do is you go like hell when you've finished and you want to go home, you head like hell for the shore. So you've got a lot of momentum, and then you'll just go up the beach or whatever it happens to be, or up the concrete landing strip. And then you'll come to a dead stop because the forward motion, you can't be supported on the cushion anymore, and you'll just drop onto the ground.
What was the health and safety executive's objection?
Well, as I say, what happened was they quickly deteriorated because there was no follow-up program. I didn't have another program next week, as it were, to use them. So they were put to one side. And then, of course, that's a very dangerous thing to do on a FIDS base because people will find all sorts of exciting things to do with them. And I think people were trying, you know, people wanted to zip around on the sea ice and all that kind of thing with them and use them for fun. And they put the mockers on it and then they just disintegrated. It was a great shame, really, because they have their uses. You know, there are certain places that hovercraft can get which nothing else can.
Are they still use that now?
No. Very few people have tried using them. The Americans tried using them before we did, But they tried using one of the big, because they're American, you know, they didn't want to use the little ones. They had one of the big ones, you know, a big cargo carrying type thing, the sort of things you'd send a whole platoon of Marines ashore on and that kind of thing. And of course, there's a limited use for that sort of thing. But actually, as a people carrier, you know, as a method of field transport, I think they're great in certain situations. And so, they would also be good now on places like George VI Sound, you see, which floods like nobody's business. They'd be brilliant on that.
Tell me a bit about the changes when the Rotherhithe runway was installed.
Yes.
And also the development of the Blue Ice runway at Sky Blue. How do those two facilities change the way you geologists and other people in the Antarctic work?
Well, of course, the hard runway at Rotherhithe, what that meant was is it just made summer working so much easier because you could just fly in and out. There were two things it did. One is it gave you the ability to operate your aircraft at almost any time. It increased the safety no end because you had an airstrip which was almost up to, in a lower way, but it's up to commercial standard. It's got lights, it's got beacons and all kinds of things like that. And if you get caught out in the field, for example, you start to fly back from a field location 200 miles away from base and the weather's starting to come down, and I've actually had this happen to me. In the old days, you'd be wondering what to do. You know, should you put down somewhere out in the boonies and wait for things to change, or can you keep going? Well, the answer is at Rotherhithe, you can probably keep going. And I've landed in sort of thick fog at Rotherhithe because there were landing lights and things like that. So it's certainly improved field safety. The other thing, of course, it did was it provided the opportunity for an intercontinental aircraft. The word's gone out of my mind.
Dash 7.
The Dash 7, that's it, the Dash 7 to fly in and out. So, you know, you can fly in from Punta Arenas, southern South America, or you can fly in from the Falkland Islands directly. And that means that in just a few hours, you can be in the Antarctic. So in fact, in theory, today, you can fly from Bryce Norton, if that's where they still go from. You fly from Bryce Norton to the Falkland Islands, which is about, in round figures, it's 24 hours because there's a stopover at Ascension Island, that's right. There's a stopover. And maybe spend a night in Stanley and then catch your Dash 7. And certainly with it, you can be at Rotherhithe in less than 2 days from leaving your house. From locking the door in Cambridge, you can be at Rotherhithe in less than 2 days. So that's changed. I mean, that's changed everything.
And Sky Blue?
Sky Blue provided the opportunity for the Dash 7 to operate into the field. The Dash 7 only has wheels. It doesn't have skis. The opportunity for fitting the Dash 7 with skis was looked at, but was deemed too expensive, apparently. But anyway, so that means the Dash 7 cannot land on snow, but it can land on a hard surface. Now, there are two ways of getting around that. One is you can maintain a hard surface on snow, and the Russians have done, and I think still do that, at places like Novolavarevskaya or somewhere like that.
Are you talking tarmac here?
No, you're talking of a snow surface you maintain with scrapers and rollers and right, whatever. It's a full-time process. It's staggeringly expensive.
And like preparing a wicket.
Yes, plus the fact that the locations of these things are near a coast, so you can get the heavy equipment, you can get in and by ship, and then you can drive it up. Now, working in the peninsula and all places south is different because you need places that you can operate from which are way inland. No, and how are you going to, if you can't get your Dash 7 there, well, a Dash 7 couldn't take a road roller anyway, you know. And so it was the idea of having a prepared snow strip that was not on. The alternative is to have a prepared ice strip, because that is a hard surface. It sounds frightening, actually, to land in wheels. We were talking about getting your skidoo stuck on blue ice. Apparently, if you've got wheels, it's all right. And that's what they did. They found this area of blue ice. A lot of preparation had to be done because there were, you have to keep all the any lumpy bits off. I had no part in doing that, but I think a lot of people did a lot of work with ice axes and things like that to prepare the runway. But what that means is you can quickly get people and larger amounts of equipment, fuel particularly, and food, into a remote location. And then the Twin Otters can operate from that as a hub. So again, that changed the... it just changes one's ability to operate in the field much more effectively. Much more expensively, but much more effectively.
Let's reconvene in the morning.
Right, okay.